My name is Ted Peters, and the topic for this morning is UFOs. We're going to have actually two presentations on this subject, and this is the first. And if you saw the bulletin board, we're dividing them into facts today and theory tomorrow. Life is never that clean and neat, but we're going to roughly try to do that. I've probably been asked 1,000 times and at least 5 times or more since coming to Holden Village this summer the following question. Do you believe in UFOs? And I'm pondering that question. My answer, after thinking about it for a number of years, is this. No, I don't believe in UFOs. I believe in God. UFOs, however, are a rather interesting subject to study. What I want to know is, why is it that the question about belief is associated with UFOs? You probably heard that question too. I mean, why do you believe is a question that has religious connotations to it. Yet UFOs, as I'm going to suggest here, is basically a mystery that's subject to investigation and research in an attempt to solve that mystery. But for some reason or another, UFOs have religious implications, and that's reflected in the question, do you believe in UFOs? Why should we study UFOs? I've got two answers. One of which is complicated, and the other of which is simple. Complicated answer first. My field is systematic theology. I teach men and women who are going into the ministry the doctrines of the church that you can find in the Apostles' Nicene Creeds and other such places. But when I do systematic theology, I want very much for it to be relevant, to be meaningful to the culture in which we live, and so I feel it's my obligation to take a look at the cultural situation in which we find ourselves. Sounds boring, doesn't it? I find it immensely exciting. Since the Second World War, I think that we in the Western world are in a tug of war over the role that science should play in our culture and in the way in which we think. And I find that the UFO phenomenon provides us with a window into that struggle. It's a kind of barometer or measuring device that tells us something about the fabric of our civilization. And I'm going to try and develop this a little bit more tomorrow. But the second reason that I think that I like to study UFOs, and maybe you do too, is it's just plain interesting. It's fascinating. One of the most compelling subjects that I know. What I would like to do today, before we venture into Ted Peters' theories on such things, which I think we'll get into primarily tomorrow, is I'd like to share with you what I think is the database, the pool of information that we have to deal with when talking about the subject, because I've learned you can't take it for granted that everybody has exactly the same body of information on the subject. We get snippets of it here and there from news broadcasts and television talk shows and newspaper articles and that kind of thing. But the phenomenon has been studied as a whole, and I'd like to give you today a brief overview of what I call the observational data, or looking at your yellow outline, the classification of UFO experiences. Note how the outline is divided. We'll look for explanatory hypotheses, that is to say, ways of explaining the data later. But in the meantime, let's just look at the reports as they come to us and break down the reports in terms of various kinds of categories that will help us to work with them. So what I would like to do is describe these 7 different kinds of UFO experiences. And then I'm going to show some slides which will illustrate the categories that I'm talking about. Well, the first two kinds of UFOs are numbers 1 and 2, nocturnal lights and daylight discs. Nocturnal lights, I call them fly-by-nights, are usually lights that are seen in the sky at night. Lights that you cannot identify. But just because you can't identify it, that doesn't make it immediately a UFO, an unidentified flying object. They count as UFOs only after investigation. This past Saturday night, Chuck Mayer and my son Paul and I and some of the other staff were camping out at Domkey Lake. It was late. There were no street lights on, no radios or anything. What are you going to do? You look at the sky. While we were staring at the sky and chit-chatting and stuff like that, we saw a light start from one horizon and move very rapidly across the entire sky and go to the other horizon. None of us knew what it was. We speculated, well, it can't be an airplane because it's too high and going too fast. Could it be a satellite or whatever it is? Well, I don't know what it is, but that's not yet a UFO. It would become a UFO after we had quizzed the airport to find out whether or not an airplane had traversed that particular path at that time, whether or not it was a satellite, whether or not it was a weather balloon. After we had checked out the obvious possibilities of what it could be, if it still remains a mystery, then it qualifies as an unidentified flying object. Nightlights constitute about 51% of UFO reports. The other 49% are daylight discs, and it's from the daylight disc category that we get the phrase flying saucer. The two professional groups that are most likely to see UFOs are policemen and airline pilots. And airline pilots in particular provide us with some of the best cases of the daylight disc type. Typically, a metallic-looking object like two saucers inverted and glued together is the most common sight. The word flying saucer comes to us from 1947 when a pilot was flying here in the state of Washington near Mount Rainier, Rainier. And he saw 9 such daylight disks flying in formation at a speed that he estimated about 1,600 miles per hour, 1947. That's faster than any plane that we had. And in trying to describe these objects, fishing for words, he says they skipped along like saucers skipping across water. And one newspaper reporter picked up the phrase flying saucer, and it's been with us ever since. A third kind of observational case is the photographic case. One would think that given the debate as to whether UFOs exist or not, that if you could take a photograph of a UFO, that would settle the debate. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of UFO photographs, but the debate goes on. A computer scientist who belongs to one of the UFO research organizations that I also belong to has borrowed a technique of computer photographic analysis from the CIA that was developed in the early 1960s for the U-2 flights, wherein a photograph taken of the ground is computer enhanced. A given photograph is divided into 239,000 pixels, PIC for picture, cell, CELL, and analyzed with a fine-tooth comb, so to speak. Also through a form of computerized analysis, he believes that we can tell with a high degree of accuracy whether or not the object photographed is solid or not, and a number of other things. Now, he believes that through this method, he can tell with a high degree of certainty whether a photograph is authentic or whether it's a hoax. If you've got a little model and you're hanging from a string, his computer is going to find that string. In fact, I had one photograph given me by a witness that he photographed this out of the airplane. All I saw was out of the airplane window was a little white blob. I sent it to him, and he sent it back, and he said, "It's a bird." He was able to take that white blob apart and see the wings. All right, now, he said, anyone who has a UFO photograph can send it to me, and for the lab fees, I will give you an analysis. And last I heard, he'd analyzed 825 pictures, photographs of UFOs. And out of that analysis, he said 80% were hoaxes. He could prove they were a hoax of one kind or another. Of the remaining 20%, 18% or so, I said that wrongly, another 18% were accidental photographs. That is to say, they were not really unidentified flying objects, but perhaps a lens flare, a little flash of light got onto the negative during the developing process. And if you happen to have sky and a little flash of light gets on, it looks like a UFO, but because he can discern whether or not an object is solid or not, he can tell you that's only a flash of light and not really an object. However, he says that he has 25 to 30 pictures that pass all of his analyses. I'll show you one in a couple of minutes. Fourth, radar and radar visual cases. A radar case all alone sounds rather convincing, but as I understand radar operators, that you can have what they call anomalous propagation. That's a fancy word for saying, I don't know what it is. If you have two radars beamed on the same object, that would give you a slightly higher degree of certainty. But if you could combine radar with a visual sighting at the same time, you'd have a high degree of confidence. An example, July 1952 was a period in which we had a UFO flap, F-L-A-P. A flap is a large number of sightings in a short period of time. 1952 in general was a flap year. 1,501 sightings were reported to the U.S. Air Force for that year, 539 of which occurred during the month of July alone. The Democratic National Convention was going on towards the end of the month, and it couldn't even make front page because UFOs over Washington were grabbing all of the headlines. Night after night, UFOs were sighted over Washington, especially July 18, 19, and then July 27 to 29. The UFOs were picked up on more than one radar scope simultaneously from different airports. F-94 jets were scrambled to intercept. In one particular case, where the UFO was being tracked on the ground radar, the pilot was also tracking it on his radar. He drew close enough so that he could see it. We've got two radar scopes and a visual sighting. It was a bright light. He was following the bright light. And on occasion, he found himself amidst two such objects on each side of his wing. The speeds of these UFOs were tracked normally between 100 and 130 miles an hour. One of them was going 7,000 miles per hour through the atmosphere. Harry Truman's telephone rang continually during that period. Fifth, close encounters of the first kind. Now, the next three categories are close encounters, and we divide them into subcategories. These categories come to us from the astronomer at Northwestern University, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who for 18 years was a U.S. Air Force lackey, whose job was to prove that anyone who claimed to see a UFO was seeing a natural phenomenon and that UFOs did not exist. He became converted to, note the religious connotation, he became converted to taking scientific seriousness toward the UFO phenomenon in the late 1960s. Close encounters of the first kind would be to witness a UFO close enough so that you can get considerable detail, that is to say, within 500 feet. A case that I worked on in New Orleans, there was a woman with her 12-year-old son. Their name was Rodriguez. And they were driving home early in the evening in St. Bernard Parish, which is near New Orleans. They were driving down the St. Bernard Highway. Brian was 12, she was the mother. And as they were about to turn on the highway, they saw an object, the disc-shaped object with a little upside-down cup on top, probably 30 to 50 feet in diameter, flying parallel to them. It crossed the highway, and then they turned left, and now it was on their right side. And they drove down the highway at approximately 40 miles per hour. The unidentified flying object flew parallel 100 or 200 feet off the ground, but in a stop-and-go fashion. Sometimes it would drop behind, sometimes it would go ahead, it would tilt back and forth. There were multiple colors that the bottom part of it would turn. It took them 10 minutes or so down the St. Bernard Highway before they had to turn off to go to their home, and at that particular point, the UFO flew on and disappeared over the horizon. There was independent confirmation by another witness who did not know this couple, so that it was seen by more than one person independently at the same time. I interviewed Mrs. Rodriguez and had the son, Brian, draw me a picture. And it's typical when I do such an interview to tape record it. And I explain before I begin the interview that I might subject this tape to a psychological stress evaluator. And when I was in New Orleans, I knew a detective had an agency and used the PSE, which is a form of lie detector. And would it be okay then if I make the tape and also subject it to a lie detector? Yes, that was fine. 3 days later, I got a panic call from Mrs. Rodriguez. She says, "Did you put it on the lie detector yet?" And I said, "No, I haven't." She says, "Well, I want to correct something." And I thought, okay, the whole thing's a hoax, you know. It's going to fall through. I said, "Okay, would you tell me then what's on your mind?" She says, "Well, during the interview, I said I was 31. I'm really 32. Close encounters of the second kind, I have two subcategories. A close encounter of the second kind is one in which there's a physical effect of some kind or another. The first of that is called a landing trace case. That is to say that a UFO would touch the ground in which perhaps there would be potholes in the ground, burn grass, lots of cases where grass is either laid down in a circle or perhaps burned in a circle, broken tree limbs, that sort of thing. As far as I know, at least Mutual UFO Network, an organization that I'm concerned with, knows of 1,300 and some landing trace cases. And there was a myth promulgated by, I think his name was Franklin Press, NASA science advisor to President Carter, that there is no such thing as physical evidence that can be analyzed by the laboratory. That's wrong. There is a tremendous amount of physical evidence available for such analysis. The second kind of close encounter of the second kind are electromagnetic effects. And those of you who saw the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind saw how Spielberg put that into the movie when the man was driving the truck, if you may remember, and all of the electrical circuits went off. There's a large number of UFO sighting cases in which this happens. You'll be driving along, you'll spot the UFO, it'll come within close vicinity of the car, then the electrical circuits go off, the car stalls. When the UFO is out of the vicinity, then all circuits seem to return to normal functioning. One of the most dramatic examples of a close encounter of the second kind occurred over Turkey in August of 1976. As I understand the relationship between the United States and Turkey at that particular time, we have our U.S. Air Force ground personnel in charge of ground operations, while it is Turkish pilots that fly our fighter planes. In this case, about 12:30 at night, an object was sighted on radar, and they scrambled one F-15 jet fighter, which I understand can go up to Mach 2 in speed. to chase, give chase to this object. The fighter was in the sky and, in fact, was chasing at nearly Mach 2 speed. The object was 20 miles distant. The pilot describes over the radio what the object looked like. It was a large, oval-shaped, glowing object. And while the pilot is conversing now over the radio with the tower, this object emits a smaller, lighted object that comes flying straight back at the pilot in the plane. He described the smaller object as about 1/4 the size of the larger one. "What should I do?" he says. The ground control said, "Fire." So he pushed the triggers on his AIM-9 missiles, and all of his electrical instrumentation went off. The plane went into a natural dive. He was able to pull it out of the dive, and when he leveled off again, all of his instrumentation returned to normal, and the smaller of the two objects was now pacing him directly behind the plane. The whole incident observed on radar from the ground. The pilot was in a panic, so the tower ordered him to land. A second plane was scrambled, which followed the second object. Then they watched on radar, went back and joined the first object. The second pilot chased the UFO out into the desert, and then the UFO finally flew straight up and disappeared into space. Electromagnetic effects. The third of those close encounters is close encounter of the third kind. And as Spielberg says, that's when you see them. That's when there is a creature of one kind or another associated with the UFO. And just going out into the woods and meeting Bigfoot or Yeti will not count as a close encounter of the third kind. There has to be a direct association between the creature and the UFO. As far as I know, there are about 300 and some odd close encounters of the third kind that you would want to take seriously. Obviously, this is the category in which you're going to get the greatest amount of excessive imagination and the kind of attempts at hoax, etc., that really create problems for investigation and research. However, there are a large number of cases in which the integrity seems to remain intact. People who are not necessarily, or who are not at all, in fact, publicity seekers or seeking some sort of personal gain, who have reasonably good status in society, and yet people who are nearly traumatized by an overwhelming experience. I'm going to mention a couple of those when I get to the slides, and perhaps I can go to the slides at this point. Would somebody be so kind as to hit the light switch back there? It'll save me from getting tangled up in this electrical spaghetti. As I mentioned before, UFOs come in flaps, large numbers of sightings in short periods of time. And this map is an attempt to convey two things. Number one, UFOs are not a phenomenon limited to our own part of the world. The UFO phenomenon in its present phase dates from 1946, where the first UFOs were sighted over Sweden. And then for you and me in the United States, beginning in 1947. If you can see up here in the United States, we have a list of the flap periods. Well, 1947 is not mentioned there, but our flaps are 1947. Oh, yeah, there it is. 1947, 1950, 1952. I just mentioned that a couple of minutes ago. 1965 to 67, actually, that was almost unabated. 1966 had a large number of UFOs. The last flap that we know of occurred in 1973. If there is such a thing as a cycle, we're overdue for more of them. France, I think it was 1954 in particular, there was a large number of sightings, etc. This is planet Earth. Remember, we should not breathe its air, drink its water, or eat any of its junk foods. I've written a book on UFOs, and I really work hard at trying to understand the relationship between our conceptual sets, our predispositions, our presuppositions, and what role that plays in interpreting UFOs. Now, this is an example of nocturnal lights. The case here is called the Lubbock Lights. Occurs in August of 1951. It starts one evening with four professors from a local junior college, Texas Technical College, and they're sitting out in the backyard on a summer's evening drinking whatever four technical college professors would drink on a summer's evening. And overhead, they see an array of white lights that pass from horizon to horizon. That began a series of such evenings for a week or so in which these lights occurred. This was taken on a subsequent night by an 18-year-old teenager who was ready with his camera, and they came by. The United States Air Force, which after 1952 saw as its mission in life to debunk, and in fact that was their official policy, using that word, to debunk UFO sightings, claim that what we have here are Canadian geese with grease on their bellies flying over the city at night and reflecting the lights of the city. That argument never convinced the citizens of Lubbock. One of the big questions that is asked regarding UFOs when they are tracked on radar, and sometimes they're tracked on radar at going excessive speeds, and then they make right angle turns, something that our terrestrial aircraft are incapable of doing. And so some of the UFO buffs theorize that they must have their own source of gravity, because as far as we know, things subject to Earth's gravitational pull cannot perform that way. Now, this is a very interesting case. This is the case of Paul Trent, McMinnville, Oregon, May 11th, 1950. And in my judgment, this is the single best pair of photographs. I'll show you another one in a minute. Paul Trent was a farmer outstanding in his field. Farmers are often found outstanding in their fields. And he saw this daylight disc, which he described as about 30 feet in diameter, metallic, reflecting sunlight. He called to his wife, who was in the house, if she would please bring the camera out of the house. And she ran out of the house with a camera, and he snapped this picture. Then he reset the camera, and he snapped this picture, so that he got them at two slightly different angles. Note how the ship has hovered and moved back and forth. After the second picture, Mr. and Mrs. Trent claimed the UFO flew directly over their heads and off, and that as it went by, they thought they sensed that the air in its wake was warmer than the other air. Now, as I mentioned to you before, I have this colleague who does computerized analysis of photographs, and in his judgment, these photographs pass all tests. There is no string. There is no. It is a solid object. It is about the same size as Mr. Trent says it is. And what I think is absolutely startling is the following. There was a so-called scientific study of UFOs funded by the U.S. government from the years 1967 to 1969. And the head of that particular project was a scientist by the name of Edward Condon. There are a number of controversial aspects about this study, but the long and the short of it is this, that Condon recommended in the introduction to the final report that UFOs do not exist in any significant way and that nobody ought to study them. And after a thorough examination of all of the thorough examination of all of the evidence, that no case was found in which the evidence stood up to scientific testing. The only trouble is that there were a number of researchers on this project, and Condon did not read the reports of the researchers before he drew his conclusion. And in that report, when you look up this case, the researchers who investigated it, they went out to the farm, they looked at the telephone wires, they examined the photos microscopically, they said, these are authentic photos and stand exactly as you see them. This is a blow-up of the two, and I put these here because of the next photo, which was taken in Rouen, France in 1954, and I just find it very interesting that it's so similar to those that were taken in McMinnville, Oregon, 3 years earlier. Now, this was a photograph taken near the island of Trinidad, off the coast of Brazil. It was a Brazilian Navy ship. The ship was doing some normal maneuvers. It was disembarking from the dock, and a professional photographer was taking photographs of the disembarkment. On the other side of the ship, a number of people saw this UFO flying parallel to the ground, coming across the sea, headed toward the island. They called for the photographer. The photographer came over and snapped a series of, I think, 6 pictures of it in different positions. Here, briefly, is a map showing picture number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 as it flew to the island, then turned around and flew off in the other direction. They have affidavits, I think, of the 20-some-odd people that saw it, affidavits from a dozen or so that would actually sign their name on the dotted line that they'd witnessed it. Do they come to us from a technologically superior civilization? Now, this photograph is and thought by most UFO buffs to be the best colored photograph of a UFO taken by a nurse, Ella Louise Fortune, in 1957 in Arizona. She was working for the Bureau of Indian Affairs at the time. And this picture of a UFO has appeared again and again in UFO magazines, journals, books, etc. However, as I mentioned to you before, I have this colleague that thinks that he can smoke out a hoax. He puts this in that 18% category. It's not a direct hoax, but it's not a UFO either. It is a lens flare. And upon quizzing Ella Louise Fortune, she says, well, she didn't remember seeing the UFO, but when she developed the picture, there it was. And he says, it's not a solid object. The computer was able to show it, hence it's a little flash of light which appeared sometime during the developing process. This is the Rex Heflin case. This is a controversial one, and in a moment I'm going to explain why. Rex Heflin, I think it's 1966, if I'm not mistaken, August 3rd, 1965. Heflin worked for the Department of Highways for the state of California. This is Southern California. He normally drives a pickup truck and normally carries a Polaroid camera in the front seat of his truck. He's driving down the highway and he spots this UFO. He pulls his truck off to the side of the road. He picks up his camera and he takes this photograph out through the windshield. The UFO now flies around the right-hand side of the truck. He takes this picture number 2. Then he leans over, takes picture number 3. At this particular point, the daylight disc now flies parallel to the ground and straight ahead parallel to the highway. Heflin starts his truck, follows it down the highway for a couple of miles. The UFO stops and hovers and then starts heading straight up into the sky and disappears into the cloud. And here is the picture of a smoke ring that it left as it disappeared into the cloud. Shortly after it became known that Heflin had this UFO experience, 3 government officials show up at Heflin's door, flash him their credentials. It's said, Department of Agriculture, I think. I don't know why the Department of Agriculture would be interested in UFOs. But at any rate, they wanted to borrow these photographs for analysis. And would he please give them to him? He had copies made, luckily. And they even gave him a receipt in the whole business. And then they disappeared, and he never saw them again. He called every government agency that he could, was never able to retrieve them. Most UFO buffs or advocates believe that this is one of the most convincing of the series of UFO pictures. However, I mentioned my friend to you, and let me tell you what he says. He says it's a hoax. And let me give you the reason why. Take a look at these telephone poles here. Note that you can go out to this spot, as he did, and you can measure the distance from those between those telephone poles. Note how this range of hills in the background is clouded and blurry compared to the things immediately in the foreground. If you've ever looked in a long distance and tried to take pictures, it's just normally the case that things that are far away are blurry compared to those things that are close, and the reason for that is there's small particulate matter in the air, and the further you get away, the more blurry are the edges of things. Now, what he can do with his computer analysis is to measure the degree of clarity of the edges of the objects in a picture, and he can get an exact measurement of the relative degree of clarity. And here, by measuring the edges of these telephone poles, he can set up a formula to determine the exact location of everything in the picture. By comparing the edge enhancement of this object to the telephone poles, he says this object is 3 feet in diameter and much closer to the truck. Consequently, he believes that it's a hoax. He doesn't know how the object was put in the sky that way. There's no string. But he believes it's a hoax. And so there's a raging argument going on now in the UFO circles as to who's right. Have astronauts ever seen unidentified flying objects? Yeah, there's about 18 documented cases from the Apollo program. James McDivitt was, I think, probably the first one to go public with regard to his sighting of a UFO while in space, 1965. And he was in his space capsule, and he saw an object flying past his space capsule, which he described as looking like a large beer can, white in color, and sticking out of one end of this beer can would be a narrow object, something like a pencil. And it was moving past him, but he had enough time to grab two cameras, a movie camera and a regular still picture camera, and photograph it with both. When he returned to the ground, he asked if he could be called to the photographic laboratory immediately upon development because he wanted to see what these pictures looked like. Well, the laboratory called him down there at his request, and they said that one of the cameras had malfunctioned, but they could squeeze one frame out of the movie camera, and this is the picture they showed him. He said that doesn't look at all like the object that he saw. Now, McDivitt has made no accusations, but those people who are inclined towards a government conspiracy theory that the government is withholding information have climbed upon this case to suggest that information has been suppressed. Now, this looks like a great picture of a UFO taken by a Swiss farmer. This Swiss farmer claims to have had 175 close encounters of the third kind with beings from another planet. A philosopher from outer space by the name of Sinyazi has communicated to him great wisdom. When I read Sinyazi's great wisdom, it looks like truncated Hinduism. And he's taken some magnificent photographs. He came to Oakland, California, and charged $12 admission to his lecture. And as I understand it, quite a few people paid the money and went. I didn't. An 18-year-old kid in the San Francisco area who belongs to one of our UFO clubs decided to investigate. And as I mentioned to you before, there's a computer analysis process, and this friend of mine that I mentioned isn't the only one that does it, and it's become quite widely used in UFO research. The thermogram is one of the procedures that is used to try and determine density of the object. And in a book published by this Swiss farmer, he claims that he took it to a laboratory, thank goodness, in San Jose, California, in which the computer enhancement analysis was done, thermograms were done, etc., which confirmed the authenticity of his pictures, photographs. Well, this 18-year-old kid decides he's going to investigate, so he goes to that laboratory in San Jose. He talks to the people there who had done the photographic analysis. They said, oh, we never did an analysis. He just came in and asked us if we'd color up the pictures real nicely. Well, luckily, the kid's parents were going on vacation in Europe, so he went with them. He went to Switzerland. He went to the guy's house and interviewed, and he started poking around in the barn, and he found, He found the model in the barn that was used in the photographs. He also found in the wastebaskets in the barn crumpled up examples of photographs that didn't turn out too well. This photograph was sent to me by a man in Venezuela who claims that he saw this UFO at 5 o'clock in the morning while driving through the city. And I have no way of interviewing him to double check with regard to his integrity. But let me ask you a question. This is the city, and I note relatively sharp, yet the edges around the UFO hovering over the city seem to be blurry, which might give evidence of what? About the focus mechanism in the camera. I would think that the focus mechanism in the camera was probably set at infinity, which means that any object that is very, very close to the lens of the camera is liable then to be blurry. So my suspicion is that this is extremely close to the camera and probably very small. And now I have a theory as to what it is. Anybody want to take a guess? What is it? A suction cup on the windshield of the car, I think. And I think this is the dashboard of the car, probably. This is a close encounter of the second kind, and this occurred in just outside of New Orleans. And I'm doing an interview here. This is Captain Pinky, the fire department. And actually, the fire department consists of two men, Captain Pinky and his assistant. And they were out in their boat at night hunting nutria, which is against law. So they're a little reluctant about having any publicity about the case. And they were moving slowly in their motorized boat down one of the canals, and they had their shotguns across their laps. And a bright light descended from the sky and hovered above them at approximately 70 feet. And Richard Mellarine, who is this fellow on the right, he was in the front of the boat, and they both said that his hair stood on end. I'd heard about that, but they claimed that they had to forcefully mat it back down after the incident. The light was so bright that it lit up the entire area, they claimed. They also claimed that the boat was suspended, that it wouldn't move anymore. The motor was churning the water, but the boat would not move. They also claimed that even though they could talk to one another, they couldn't move their arms because they discussed shooting the thing. But they couldn't pick their guns up off their laps. It hovered there for a few minutes, then it flew off some 500 yards or so and began to hover near a water tower, at which time they immediately drove their boat to dock, got out, and went home as fast as they could. There's a continuing story with that one, but I'll leave you with just the close encounter of the second kind. Close encounters of the third kind. You want to know what a person from outer space looks like? Well, you buy one of those newspapers at the grocery store, like I did here, And you can get the best scientific research reported there. Here's an alien being sketched on the basis of a release from the United States Air Force. Well, there's no footnote there, if you may notice. It would be hard to double-check that one. As far as I know, with regard to close encounters of the third kind that you want to take seriously, this is not a description of what they look like. What do they look like? There are three basic types, but actually only two that you and I want to take seriously. This is type one. Type one is usually short, grayish skin, sometimes in uniform, sometimes in a helmet, sometimes not. The eyes are usually very striking. In the Betty and Barney Hill case in New Hampshire, which I may mention in a couple of minutes if I have time, the eyes seem to go further around the side of the head than yours and mine do, which give the impression that they had much wider peripheral vision. This is the model for the UFOnaut that was used by Steven Spielberg in his movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I want to say something more about that movie tomorrow. Let me just say in general that there's a big difference between science fiction and the UFO phenomenon. A lot of people are fooled, especially journalists who write newspaper articles, don't know that what goes on in science fiction is totally different from that which goes on in the UFO phenomenon. Spielberg's movie is one of only two movies that ever tried to present the phenomenon as it genuinely is. Now, the artist here describes this this UFO occupant as 7 feet tall, handsome. My wife likes this occupant the best. However, in my own reading and conversing with UFO witnesses, they're not 7 feet tall. Even those that look like terrestrial human beings are either our height or shorter. I just don't know of any 7 foot tall accounts. These are the two most widely reported types of UFO occupants. Here's type three, and maybe that's one of the pets that they just have brought with them to Earth, and that every once in a while they need to stop and let the dog go out and water. Gads, one of them is approaching now. It's too horrible to describe. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Now, this is an artist's conception of the UFOnaut witnessed by Betty and Barney Hill in September of 1961, when they were driving home from vacation in Canada to their home in New Hampshire. And as it was late in the night, they were making a night drive, a UFO paralleled the car. And to make a long story short, they claimed to have been abducted, taken aboard the UFO, taken into separate rooms within the craft. And then these spacelings proceeded to do what Betty describes as something like a physical examination of their bodies. Little pieces of skin, cuttings from hair and toenails, etc. And Betty was conscious and aware, and she conversed with these people, sometimes linguistically, sometimes telepathically. And it eventually became the basis for a Look magazine article, then a book called The Interrupted Journey, and finally, I think it was 1976, a television program, the name of which I've forgotten. When the television program was being prepared, this is what the TV people used as their form for representing the people from outer space. One of the most fantastic controversies and mysteries associated with the Betty and Barney Hill case is the famous fish map, or star map. Betty Hill engages the spaceling in a conversation and asks where they come from. And he says, well, you're not going to understand, but let me try to explain. And so he presents to Betty Hill a three-dimensional map. And shows her a number of lines. He says, these are star systems. The wide lines represent trade routes. The dotted lines, exploratory routes. And he points to one of them, and I can't remember which one now, is the present solar system in which you and I live. and it's on the one of the dotted lines up there. I don't know enough astronomy to be specific. And he says, this is our home, referring to that basketball there, the second one up from the lower right-hand corner. Well, the reason it's called the fish map is that after Betty Hill had drawn this map, a woman astronomer by the name of Marjorie Fish tried to discern where the location of the home would be, and the map is drawn not from the perspective of our solar system looking out, but rather from the perspective of their solar system looking at the rest of space. So she had to construct in a gymnasium a model of the neighborhood of the universe that we've got, with balls hanging from ceilings, etc., simulating the stars, in order to find the perspective. Once she did that, she thought she had it. Then she turned her research over to the astronomy department at Ohio State University, which then computerized it and confirmed her findings. Zeta 2 Reticuli, about 30 light years away, is now the working hypothesis for the location that they claim to have come from. This is the Sandy Larson case. Sandy lives in Fargo, North Dakota. This is a very crude drawing, of course, but her experience is allegedly the same as that of Betty Hill. She was abducted with her daughter and daughter's boyfriend in the, from her car driving down Interstate 95 to Bismarck in the middle of the morning. I think it was August 19th, 1976. No, August 26th. And removed from her car and similarly given a what she claims to be a physical examination of some type here. She says that this fellow reamed her nose with a metallic instrument that hurt quite a bit initially, but that later on she found her sinuses cleared up, and that helped her quite a bit. This is the Charles Hickson, Calvin Parker, Pascagoula, Mississippi case, October 11th, 1973, and this is probably the most widely known close encounter of the third kind ever. It ran in almost all of the major newspapers all over the world within 2 days of its occurrence. You may even remember that. Charles Hickson later appeared on Dick Cavett's show, Johnny Carson, and other places for interviews. I myself went to Pascagoula and interviewed Hickson. Calvin Parker was put into an insane asylum directly following, and he only occasionally goes back to visit his father, who lives in Tucker's Crossing. And his father doesn't want him to meet anybody from the press or any strangers. He's had a nervous breakdown. Anyway, I visited Charles Hickson and got the story from him. They were fishing. It was around 7 o'clock in the evening on the banks of the Pascagoula River, right near the Schaupeter Shipyard. Both of them were ship fitters at the time. And I'm standing approximately on the spot where they claim that this glowing UFO settled down and just hovered above the ground. It didn't land physically. They were fishing on the banks of the river, and so the UFOnauts are looking at them from this particular point. They felt themselves paralyzed. They couldn't move. And now we're looking back at the spot where the UFO came down, approximately the point at which they were doing their fishing. They only caught two catfish, by the way. Three silver-colored beings emerged from the spacecraft, they claim. They did not walk. They said that they simply levitated or floated across the ground, picked them up, took them forcibly inside the craft. Before they got into the craft, Parker fainted. Parker was about 19 years of age, by the way. Never been in a city up until 2 weeks prior to the incident. Charles Hickson was 42, been around a lot. He didn't faint. He goes into the ship. He's held there, and he tells me that an object came out of the wall, the shape of a bicycle light, the size of a football, and it was connected to nothing but went around his entire body. I said, "What do you think they were doing to you?" He says, "It was some kind of a physical examination." He believes it took about 20 minutes. Then they were taken out of the craft, set on the ground, the beings returned to the craft, the door closed up, and then it flew away. He believes the incident occurred, took about 20 minutes. It appears that from the best reports I can get, that other people in Pascagoula did claim to have seen a strange light in the area at that particular time. One interesting aspect of the case, if you look right here, you can see the bridge. This is a drawbridge. This is where the bridge tender sits. The bridge tender was quizzed, not by me, but by CBS, as to whether or not he could see, saw the UFO. The bridge tender said no, he did not see the UFO at that particular time of night. That would be a key witness if it could be verified. However, this is the bridge tender's office, and I did go up there. The chair in which the bridge tender sits has its back to this particular corner, so that it's not likely that the bridge tender would be looking in this direction. This is looking down the Pascagoula River the other way. I built up a friendship with Charles Hickson. I did subject one of his tapes to a psychological stress evaluator with the detective. It was confirmed that he was telling the truth on every point except one. He was telling the truth in his entire description of what happened to him. By telling the truth, we mean, of course, that he believes what he said. That's all a lie detector test can do. However, he said that he believes that a UFO is going to come back and someday take him off to live in another world, he and his wife. On that particular point, the PSC registered stress. He's not telling the truth, which makes me speculate. Maybe he'd like to take his secretary instead of his wife. I don't know. Gee, they seem awfully happy to see us, whoever they are. Here's some statistics which I think are interesting. This is a Gallup poll. Note, first of all, here, we're talking November 1973. Now, this is in the later stages of the 1973 flap, so UFOs are in the news at this particular point. 11%, that is to say, if that percentage holds, 15 million adult Americans claim to have had at least one UFO experience. On the question, in your opinion, are UFOs something real or just people's imagination? I find something interesting. Note 1966, 46% thought they were real. That goes up moderately to 1973, where 51% say yes. But look at the breakdown on education. There's one myth that's promulgated that only stupid people, drunken farmers, down on their South 40, three sheets to the wind at night, take UFOs seriously. However, looks like the greatest number of skeptics have a grade school education only. High school, there are more believers, and college the most. Compare that with the age group breakdown. 18 to 24 has the highest, and it goes down in terms of age group. Now, is it age? That is to say, the younger you are, the more gullible you are. It strikes me that there's probably a simultaneous correlation between age and education, given the way educational patterns have changed in our country. So education is more likely the factor that determines what people think. Okay, can we have the lights turned on, please? Okay, that concludes my description of the observational data. And how we're going to think about it, how we're going to explain it, that's another question, and we'll get to that one tomorrow. I think we've got a minute or two for questions, and then we're going to have to break for lunch. Yeah?
There's no data on time of day. Is there any relationship between time of day and the sighting? And I know that most of them are at night or in the evening.
That's a good question. The question is, what can we say statistically about the time of day of sightings? Yes, the statistics have been run by the hour, and the hour in which the greatest number of UFOs are sighted is between 2 and 3 in the morning. The second most popular period is from 10 to 11 at night. And then the rest of them seem to be distributed throughout the rest of the day. And as to exactly why they're sighted at that particular time, we can only speculate. You know, some people say, oh, they don't want to be seen. That's why they come only at 2 and 3 in the morning. So every time I'm out at 2 or 3 in the morning, I'm looking. Yes?
Are there any of the verified cases of the third kind where people are harmed?
That's another question, a good question. The question is, in close encounters of the third kind, are people harmed? There's only one case in which serious harm occurred, and I think that may be an anomaly. It is widely thought among science fiction people that the UFOnauts are coming to us like enemies for war. It's also thought amongst very right-wing fundamentalist Christians that they come from the devil, hence they do damage. The data does not bear that out. In almost all cases, they're either benign or harmless, and in some cases they do good. Now, there have been minor injuries that have occurred, but the minor injuries are not attributed to malevolence on the part of the spacelings. The one case in which a person died was the case of Thomas Mantell in January of 1948 near Godman Field in Kentucky, who was chasing a UFO. And he chased this UFO to approximately 20,000 feet, and his plane disintegrated. He was talking to the tower, and his plane disintegrated. And it's the theory of many that the UFO shot him out of the sky. However, two things are important. Number one, this case is not like any other case that we know. In other words, it doesn't seem to fit a pattern. Secondly, he didn't have oxygen. And it's very possible that he flew too high for a pilot to go without oxygen, and perhaps he fainted, and then something went wrong with the aircraft. So we can't be certain that we have something malevolent having happened in this case. Well, I want to thank you all for your attention. Tomorrow we'll look at the religious overtones of the whole phenomenon.